In the latest sign that Vladimir Putin's war in Ukraine is not going as planned, yesterday the Russian president appeared on TV to threaten a nuclear response and call for the mobilization of 300,000 reservists.
I think it is necessary to support the proposal of the Ministry of Defense and the General Staff to conduct a partial military mobilization in Russia. I repeat, we are only talking about a partial mobilization. Only people currently in the military reserve will be drafted, prioritizing those who have served in the armed forces and have a particular military specialization and the corresponding experience. The decree on partial mobilization has been signed.
In response, protests, some large, some small, broke out in at least 38 cities across Russia. A Russian human rights group says that more than 1,300 protesters were arrested. And they're not the only voices of dissent being heard in Russia. Even pro-Putin and pro-war TV pundits, who previously cheered the president on, have begun to openly question why the invasion of Ukraine has not gone as Putin promised. The military really set us up, said one. The president was told Ukrainians wouldn't fight, that they'd want to join Russia. It's absolutely impossible to defeat Ukraine the way we've been fighting. I'm suggesting peace talks to end the war. Full mobilization of conscripts or let's get out. Putin is under pressure. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This hour, with Putin seemingly increasingly isolated, what are the options for Russia's strongman? Joining me from Boston is Nicholas Gvozdev, Professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. Nick, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much.
So I want to start with this latest news of Putin announcing this mobilization, saying that a nuclear response is not off the table. What does that sound like to you? Is that evidence that he is vulnerable?
As you noted, the operation is not going the way he thought it would, and that many people in Russia thought it was going to go in the first days of the so-called special military operation. And really, he's now facing a series of bad choices, and he's trying to navigate between what he thinks will be the least bad options. So, as you noted, it's a partial mobilization because there are those, particularly in local government, but also in the Russian economy, who said full mobilization would disrupt the Russian economy, particularly the energy sector on which Russia depends for revenue. It would create some social unrest, as you've noted. We've had these protests across Russia in the last day. On the other hand, the military is saying we don't have enough people to control the territory that we've taken in Ukraine. We're thinly spread out. We're relying on militias and mercenaries. And what the Ukrainians demonstrated in the past 2 weeks is the ability to probe the Russian line and to be able to take back a significant amount of territory from Russian control. And so the military was saying we need more people. And this is, in essence, a compromise, which may end up satisfying no one, to call for these reservists to increase the number of personnel in Ukraine, but without perhaps causing these major societal disruptions at home, both in terms of the mobilization, but also in terms of keeping the economy going, because a key part of Putin's ability to remain in power has been the bargain that he more or less offered Russian society two decades ago, which is, I will more or less guarantee a middle-class lifestyle for many of you as long as you let me run things. And right. Mobilization and economic crisis are both failures of the bargain on his part.
And is this latest effort only making that bargain look worse to the Russian people? I mean, the idea of mobilizing more troops after thousands of Russian fighters have died in the course of this invasion. Obviously, the people know that if their loved ones did not come home, and it's a sign that this is far from over. Do you think that this will only increase the dissent inside the country?
A lot's going to depend on what the Russian strategy moving forward is going to be. There are some indications that with these announced referenda in the four regions of Ukraine Russia has occupied or has taken over, the referenda for them to declare their independence and then petition to join the Russian Federation. Is the Russian goal now to move to a defensive position, not try to take more territory in Ukraine, but safeguard what they've had, and then hope that over the winter, the economic disruptions that the sanctions and the energy cutoffs to Europe will create will cause European countries to question the level of aid that they're providing to Ukraine. And then you get some sort of frozen conflict or ceasefire in the spring, which allows Putin to claim some degree of victory in that he can say that these four regions of Ukraine have now joined Russia, and we have achieved what we set out to do in the special military operation. But that's not clear. And of course, the level of Western support for Ukraine continues. We've seen what NATO aid can do with a determined Ukrainian military in terms of not just simply holding the Russians back, but retaking territory. And that's where we run into the question of escalation, the risk that Putin, in order to stave off defeat, may be willing to countenance riskier measures, obviously nuclear escalation is the end game there. But even before that, more devastating cyber attacks, more attacks on infrastructure that really change the nature of the conflict. And so that's something we're going to be watching very carefully.
So you had mentioned that the narrative of failure in itself can be dangerous. We've seen these Kremlin-friendly television pundits who had served as cheerleaders for Putin now changing their tune and suggesting that the Russians had been misled by Putin. How dangerous is that? How do you think that is affecting the president?
It depends how that plays out. What's interesting has been how this factors into sort of internal Kremlin politics. We often have a vision of Putin as being the all-powerful strongman in Russia, but really he presides over a collective form of governance. There's a number of power centers, many of whom don't trust each other, vying for advantage. And what we've seen over the past week or so is different people saying, look, Putin, there's been these failures, but then trying to assign failures to others. So we saw President Kadyrov of Chechnya, the region in southern Russia, and a major provider of some of these auxiliary militias and National Guard units doing the fighting in Ukraine, essentially blaming the general staff, blaming the intelligence community for failure. We've had other people saying the president was misinformed and that perhaps the defense minister or the chairman of the Security Council ought to be sacked. So far where this is playing out at elite levels is less about getting rid of Putin and more about, are you going to see efforts to shift the balance? But where there has been some interesting developments is the first calls, muted but real, among some people saying the buck stops with the president, and perhaps the president himself should consider resignation or stepping down, either to wrap up the conflict or to put someone else in who will be able to be more vigorous in prosecuting the so-called special military operation.
So I want to talk a little later more about what potential scenarios might unfold. But now back on the topic of how this is playing out in Russia in a different way, you also have these mysterious deaths that have been happening within the country of oligarchs and others who are aligned with Putin. We don't know exactly what caused all of these deaths, but how is that playing into this overall narrative? of the way that the war is being seen from inside that country.
What's interesting with some of the deaths that we've seen over the past 6 months is some of them are linked to people in cases where they had expressed doubt about the outcome of the invasion or had counseled against it, and particularly when we've seen some of these deaths of senior business figures in the energy sector, particularly in companies that were very looking very much to working with Western companies to develop Russia's energy sector. All those plans, of course, are now suspended. These were some people who voiced criticism of that. We had some major Russian business figures leave the country right in March and then express opposition to the war. So some of this could be a message to the business community of it's time for you to fall into place. It's time for you to support the Kremlin, because not just simply your position, but perhaps your life itself could be impacted. On the other hand, knowing the Russian business sector, it is sometimes a cutthroat arena. And so some people may be taking advantage of this period of uncertainty to settle scores. And then finally, with some of the more recent deaths that we've seen, I don't know that we can't rule out that these, in fact, are genuine suicides by people who feel that they just can't go on given the demands that are placed on them. So, for example, this executive in the Far East who was tasked with Arctic development. On the one hand, he has a mandate to really get Russia's Arctic projects up and running on schedule. On the other hand, he has to deal with the reality of Western sanctions, which make it very difficult for that to occur. And, you know, he may be a case where this, in fact, may be someone saying, I just can't cope with this and I'm going to take this way out. So it's not always clear in each case why someone may have passed.
We're talking about the criticism of Putin's war inside Russia and what that means for a president determined to keep his grip on power. When we come back, we'll talk about how Russian elites and the broader public think the war is going. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Nick Gvozdev is our guest today. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. And we're talking about the pressures that Putin is under and how the nation is reacting and how he might react in the future. So, Nick, I want to ask you about elected officials within Russia who have accused Putin of treason, in addition to calling on him to step down. How unusual is this? And does this affect how Putin sees the way the war is going?
It's unusual for it to be so public. Now, the districts that some of these local councillors represent are strongholds of the opposition, so it's not completely out of character that you might see calls from those circles saying that what Putin is doing has mortgaged the future of Russia, has basically erased 20-some years of economic growth and development. What's more troubling for the Kremlin is less opposition figures that are known quantities, but what this is doing in that kind of more amorphous nationalist base that has so often served as a key foundation of Putin's popular support. So there's this narrative of President Putin not really serving Russian interests. Does that play? And what we just saw with this prisoner exchange between Russia and Ukraine, where Russia released some of the defenders of the Azov battalion that were in the Azovstal plant in Mariupol, in order to get a leading Ukrainian oligarch released from Ukrainian custody. Some people are raising a question about that, which is really, are you doing this for the good of Russia, or are you doing it because the oligarch in question, Mr. Medvedchuk, has familial ties with Putin, and is this a case of Putin is privileging his own interests and the interests of his supporters, particularly the business groupings that depend on him, over the country as a whole? That is a narrative that over time could gain greater traction. We certainly have seen this over the past decade, that the narrative of corruption in Russia, and that the president tolerates corruption even when that corruption erodes the national interest, is one that is very powerful. And over the last several months, people have been asking questions. Where did all this defense money go? All the defense reforms, all the equipment that we were promised, you know, how much of that was actually spent? And is that one reason why Russia is not doing as well in Ukraine as should be expected? And is it because of corruption? And is that corruption facilitated and protected by the president? That is a narrative that over time could have a much greater impact.
And to that point about the mood inside of Russia, with them being able to see evidence of this corruption that you're talking about, evidence that the war is seemingly not being managed the way that Putin promised, that it's dragging out, that you see these desertions. Here is one TV pundit after Russia's battlefield losses earlier this month saying the public is asking the Kremlin, where is our victory? He is saying social tensions could rise not because of the masses opposing the military operation, but because they might ask, why isn't it more active? Where is our victory? Nick, tell us how that mood inside the country is affecting Putin and affecting the operation of this invasion.
Well, this goes back to the tensions that Putin has to manage about how to conduct the invasion. On the one hand, people have been asking questions, particularly after the Ukrainian counteroffensive in Kharkiv. People were saying, why was it just simply militia fighters? Where was the regular army? How was the Ukrainian army able to penetrate? On the other hand, people are also wondering, do I want to go? Do I want to see my reservist son or daughter mobilized and sent? And will they be sent? And can we trust that the leadership is going to safeguard them in a way that even if someone doesn't unfortunately get killed, that they won't have died in vain? And I think that, again, this is why the Kremlin so long resisted these calls for mobilization, because once you start calling up more people, once it's no longer the bulk of the fighting is no longer being done by volunteers or by people that you could say, well, they chose to go there, they knew what they were getting into, that can start to raise questions. And even again, even though we're used to thinking of Russia as a very controlled environment, keep in mind, you know, many Russians are online. There's a vigorous online and social media conversations and discussions going on. And it's not something that can just be easily suppressed, perhaps as it might have been done during Soviet times, where people were much more atomized. And then connecting this to a larger question, which is the idea that when the operation first started, you had some of these pundits that you've been playing clips from, confidently predicting that Russia didn't need Europe, it didn't need the United States, that China and Asian countries were going to step in and there would be no economic disruption. And Russians have been seeing, and particularly after the Samarkand-Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit, that some of Russia's Asian partners not fully in, not fully supportive. And while they're doing business with Russia, they're also cognizant of the impact of U.S. sanctions. So the idea that you could just pivot Russia away from Europe towards Asia with no economic consequence. So all of this comes together, and it's not that we're predicting you know, Putin falls in 48 hours or 72 hours, but we're looking at these sources of tension, these pressures, these tectonic plates that can shift in Russia, which then can lead to dramatic political change at some point down the line.
Nick, I'm going to pause you just for a moment because I'd like to bring another voice into this conversation. Olga Ivshina is a correspondent for the BBC Russian service, and she joins us from London. Olga, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So can you talk a little bit more about the public opinion inside of Russia and what Putin's reaction has been to it?
Well, Russia is huge, right? That's why it's not easy to summarize public opinion. It's different depending on which branch sort of population you're talking about. Definitely there are ultra-patriots, people on the far right of the spectrum, those who genuinely and strongly support the war, which they call special military operation. It's hard to judge, you know, how many of them are there. Maybe 10%, I would say maximum 15%, and they strongly support this move. They actually say this should have been done even earlier. So they strongly support, and some of them, a low number of them, are even eager to join the mobilization, so to say. There is another part of the population, according to polls. It's hard to we need to be careful interpreting the polls numbers, but still at least 20-25% of population do not support this war at all. Definitely they're not happy, and we have seen protests since day one of this war in Russia. Not numerous, but still we know that thousands of people were detained and went to jail or had to pay fines. So they don't support, and there were protests yesterday, not only in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but also in some other regions where you wouldn't expect people to do so. And there is all that huge population in the middle, probably 60%, I guess, who were trying to shield off from all that, who were trying to get on with their lives, ignoring the war, trying to pretend it's not happening. And now they are definitely affected, because even though Putin and his officials said it's only partial mobilization and they won't mobilize students or those who didn't serve or whatever, no one believes them, to be honest, because Russians will know track record of their government, and they know they shouldn't believe whatever words are being pronounced officially. So yeah, people are worried, and we have seen that. Those who could afford to leave, some of them definitely left. All tickets for closest visa-free destinations have been sold out yesterday, and actually the day before yesterday, and today we see huge queues in the airport. So whoever could, they escaped. But the thing is that the majority of population can't even, they don't even have foreign passports, and on top of that, they don't have money to travel.
Well, just the fact that in recent weeks, we have seen, as you said, an increase of people trying to leave the country. Now, there is also the directive that men basically of fighting age are not able to leave the country. How is that impacting how people are seeing the war? And does that leave Putin even more vulnerable if that support wanes?
Well, I think we should be careful. I mean, definitely there is no open source, there's no document which was published in the open saying that men who of the fighting age can't leave the country. And we see that men of fighting age are actively leaving the country, have been actively leaving the country yesterday and today. Yes, some of them are stopped and questioned, but the majority are then released and they do leave the country. So I think that's not correct. The trouble is that Russian society is not homogenized. It's very much divided, and people have almost zero trust to each other. That's why they don't unite. That's why basically they, since the majority of the population since the start of the war does nothing. And it seems, at least at the moment, that many people may try to live through these times in silence because they're afraid for their relatives, because they're afraid for themselves, they're afraid to go to jail, etc. There are all sorts of reasons. This repressive regime has been developing and evolving its mechanisms for years now, for over a decade now. So there are reasons to be afraid and to be silent. I don't say it's an excuse, but what we see for at the moment, that people are not ready to protest massively. They're silent. They're thinking about their options. Some are probably thinking about where to get money to pay a bribe. To pretend they're not, you know, they can't be mobilized for whatever reasons. But we don't see any sign of active, massive protests in Russia at the moment.
And Nick, one objective of Putin was to prevent Ukraine and other nations from joining NATO. But the NATO and EU have held fast. In fact, Sweden and Finland are planning to join it. What does that do? How does that affect Putin and this invasion?
Well, definitely. It's, what he tried to prevent from happening is, in fact, occurring precisely because of the timing and how he launched the invasion of Ukraine. The question is now whether or not he can negotiate certain arrangements. So, for example, we know that Finland has offered to the Russians that, yes, Finland will be in NATO, but what we saw in Germany in 1990, we're not going to move certain components to the Russian border. But that, of course, still, increases NATO's presence along the Russian border. The real question moving forward for the West, and this is less for Putin to answer and for the West instead to answer, is we have existed in a degree of strategic ambiguity with regard to Ukraine. And keep in mind that only a year ago, President Biden, with President Zelensky standing next to him, said Ukraine would not enter into NATO for many years to come. The question is whether or not Western countries are prepared to change their thinking about integration of Ukraine and under what terms. And of course, whether or not when they're thinking about integration of Ukraine with the West, will they still be concerned about a potential Russian reaction? I can say that that has changed definitely between the 23rd and the 24th of February, based on things that Chancellor Scholz and President Macron were saying in the week before the invasion.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point. I want to talk about the impacts outside of Russia. President Putin and China's President Xi met a week ago at a summit in Uzbekistan, and they stood side by side with Putin seeming to acknowledge that he didn't have the strength of support he was looking for.
We highly appreciate the balanced position of our Chinese friends in connection with the Ukrainian crisis. We understand your questions and concerns in this regard.
Nick, what does this tell you, this reaction from Putin about that support from outside the country?
Well, it reaffirms the point that nothing succeeds like success. And when you don't succeed, your friends and partners reevaluate how close they want to be with you. It seems very likely that in the run-up to the invasion, when Putin was in China and met with Xi at the Olympics, he probably assured them that this would be a rapid invasion, Ukraine would fold, that the West would accept it as they accepted the seizure of Crimea and the seizure of Abkhazia and South Ossetia from Georgia, and that this would all be wrapped up pretty quickly. Instead, now the Chinese, on the one hand, are looking at this and saying, we don't want to have U.S. sanctions imposed on us. And so we've seen even major Chinese companies stopping certain degrees of business with Russia. On the other hand, China now is looking at this saying, we've expected Russia to more or less be our protector in the West against the advance of the Euro-Atlantic world, certainly not to expand into Central Asia. And now do we have to worry not about a strong Russia on our borders, but a weak Russia that can't even handle this sort of special operation inside of Ukraine. So definitely China is keeping its options open, and it's keeping its options open precisely because they are concerned about Russia's inability to achieve its objectives.
Olga, is this change in support or change in position of other leaders outside of the country being felt inside of the country? Do the Russian people see this, and is that adding to the mood there?
Well, to be honest, at the moment, Russian people are too busy trying to understand and sort of, you know, somehow put up with the news about mobilization. So the foreign policy at the moment is the last thing they think about. But I think what is true that actually these things are very much connected, because from the early on of his presidential career, Mr. Putin underlined that he sees East, he sees Asia and the former post-Soviet countries as his sphere of influence, and he was trying to, you know, to project his power there. He was always trying to show that, you know, Russia is strong and you should be friends with us.
I'm going to pause you there, and we'll come back after the break. We're talking about the criticism inside Russia against Putin's war in Ukraine. When we come back, we'll talk about Putin's vulnerabilities and the scenarios that can turn them into real threats to his power. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. And if you like a peek into an upcoming show we're working on or some recommendations from our team about previous shows you might have missed, then sign up for the On Point newsletter at onpointradio.org. It's simple to sign up and keep up with On Point at onpointradio.org. This hour, we're talking about Russian President Vladimir Putin's grip on power and the recent open criticism of him and his war effort in Ukraine. My guests are Olga Ivshina, a correspondent for the BBC Russian Service, and Nick Gvozdev, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. Nick, I want to talk about some potential scenarios moving forward, including one that Putin himself brought up. Last week, Russian TV pundit Igor Kohenchenko said it was time for Russia to think about using tactical nuclear weapons. He says, evidently, the time has come, perhaps, to hold drills for scenarios in which tactical nuclear weapons are used. When we encounter NATO's nuclear blackmail, we shouldn't be running around thinking about how to respond. Nick, indeed, Putin yesterday warned the West in a speech that Russia was much more powerful in terms of its nuclear capabilities and warned, quote, I'm not bluffing. What do you make of that?
I still rate the prospect of nuclear escalation as relatively low at this point, simply because the Russians also know that once you start introducing nuclear weapons into the mix, you can lose control of the situation relatively quickly. But what I do think that these nuclear threats, and again, they're not new. We heard them in February as well. Russia moved its nuclear forces on alert after the invasion started. But what this, I think, was designed to do is to remind Europeans and Americans who more or less have thought that support for Ukraine and increasing support for Ukraine is cost-free. There's no risk to us to keep sending weapons, to increase the caliber of weapons that are being sent, the range, and so on. I think this was meant to warn people that there could be costs And maybe it won't be a nuclear one, but certainly there's going to be an economic one. The cyber tool hasn't really reared its head yet, but we've seen the impact of cyber disruptions in the past. And I think it was meant just to put us on alert that we don't simply get to sit on the sidelines of the conflict, that we are also involved in it, and we may need to think about the price we're willing to pay to help Ukraine, and of course, what outcome for Ukraine we are looking for. Because right now we still are somewhat divided. Are we simply just trying to return us prior to the conditions as it existed in February? Are we talking about liberating Crimea and the Donbas, or are we talking about helping Ukraine achieve a substantial victory against Russia that would lead, if not to leadership change, to regime change in a broader sense? And I think Putin's speech was to remind us that these options come potentially with risks and costs, not just simply for Ukrainians, but for us as well.
And Olga, inside the country, what about the elites and the power brokers upon which Putin depends to maintain his power? Do you think that those alliances will be able to weather this ongoing conflict?
It's a good question. I think the trouble is that Putin's close circle, Putin's inner circle, has changed dramatically over the past 2 years, 3 years. Because if you look before the pandemic, you know, his main allies, his main close friends were actually his school friends, or you know, from judo club, who are oligarchs, who are interested in life and living. Yes, they're corrupt, but they're not military men. But due to a number of factors during the pandemic, the members of Putin's inner circle have changed completely. His friends don't get that much with him anymore. He's surrounded by people with military background, with special services background, with people with absolutely hawkish thoughts and mood. And that sort of makes it harder, you know, and when people think about what may happen after Putin, well, he's surrounded by elite who thinks maybe even harsher than his rhetoric at the moment. And I think that that is the biggest trouble. And those who, everyone with the sort of different thoughts, for them it's really, really, really hard to get access to Mr. Putin.
So there have been reports, should I say rumors, about Putin's health. We don't know how exaggerated they might be, but they can, Olga, serve as part of the narrative that could be making him seem more vulnerable from inside the country. What have you seen or heard with respect to that?
Well, those rumors do exist, but within Russia, they get really small sort of spread, because we need to remember that Instagram is blocked, Facebook is blocked, all independent media websites are blocked. Yes, you can avoid blocking, you know, using VPN, but then VPNs are blocked. So it's, you know, it's a constant catch me game, which is really hard for the Russians, because once again, economy is struggling and people are too busy surviving or now avoiding mobilization. So they don't have really that much time to, you know, to dig in, to think deeply, to research and read the news. And again, this is part of the trouble. It's not an excuse. It's just how things are. I guess people think more about different things. What is for sure, that Putin's authority and Russia's authority was reliant on power very much, both within the country and outside. And maybe this is one of the reasons why after this Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting, he suddenly called for mobilization. Because it's obvious that this plan for mobilization existed for months and months and months. It was on the table. It just haven't been used before, and it has been activated now, maybe because he feels he needs victories, small or big victories, in order to reinforce his image both internally and externally.
Nick, what about outside of the country? These rumors about his health, his inner circle shrinking the way Olga described, does that leave him more vulnerable to those outside the country?
Well, first of all, let me just say that the health narrative is important because it has been used in Russian history and political history in the past as a way to ease leaders out, most notably the retirement of Nikita Khrushchev in 1964, retiring for health reasons, the attempt to try to get Gorbachev in 1991 to accept a health-related issue to step down and pass power to the emergency committee. So there's a role for the health issue because it also allows you to ease someone out, or it allows you to blame failure. Well, he was incapacitated. I'm not saying that this is necessarily going to happen. I just wanted to alert your listeners to that, you know, the health narrative can play a role. What it also highlights, though, again, is the brittleness of the Russian political system. Yes, constitutionally, if Putin were to be incapacitated, there is no quite equivalent to the 25th Amendment in the Russian system, but there are provisions for if the president is incapacitated, the prime minister takes over, except in this case, Prime Minister Mishustin, who essentially runs the day-to-day functions of government, isn't necessarily the person who can run the political system the way Putin has created it. And this raises the question of the different Kremlin clans, who would they trust to exercise presidential authority, and the fact that we don't have necessarily clear successors. We have different candidates' names are bandied about, but it's not clear if Putin were to step down or to be asked to step down or had a health emergency that incapacitated him, who would take over? Would this be smooth? Would this be and would this transition necessarily, from an American perspective, would it be a good thing or a bad thing for us and our interests? So this creates that degree of uncertainty and instability. And again, keeping in mind how long Putin has been there, he became prime minister in 1999. And since 1999, he has either been president or prime minister of Russia. There are people who have spent their entire adult lives with Putin essentially at the helm of the country. And so that also raises a question of, well, then what next? And does it lead to change? Does it lead to more of the same? Does it lead to stability? Does it lead to instability? And these are all factors. Again, the population may not be focused on it, but the elites are very concerned about this because, as we have seen, every time there's a transition in Russia, some elites win and some elites lose. And then that makes it not just a matter of winning and losing. It can be a matter of certainly elite survival and perhaps even personal survival.
Yeah, and one point that you made, Olga, was about the energy business as it pertains to those elites. Russia expert Thane Gustafson told NPR's Morning Edition this week that threatening to withhold gas and energy supplies from Europe has backfired spectacularly.
The Russians worked very hard, assiduously, for six decades to build a gas business in Europe. And now Putin has ripped it apart. It will never recover. And that is absolutely baffling.
And Olga, we talked at the top about how some of the mysterious deaths that have happened of those who supported Putin from inside the country have been those who are in the energy business, for example. Talk a little bit about that impact and how that's affecting the narrative about Putin.
It's really hard to talk about those deaths because, you know, it partially involves speculation. What we know for sure that the mood in the industry is very dark and the mood in the industry is very depressive, you know, from top to bottom. And it has been just it has become just darker yesterday because of mobilization. I mean, like a month ago, I spoke to someone quite high, you know, like a head of one oil-related factory, and they told me that, you know, they're absolutely distressed and depressed and devastated because things, you know, they were trying to build this business, they were trying to build this enterprise for decades, actually, and now they see how it's all being destroyed, and in 2-3 years, you know, it's still working anything at the moment, but in 2-3 years it will be completely devastated. And yesterday again I spoke to someone and they said that over 100 people from another factory or oil related factory, they got this thing, you know, this mobilization warrants. So this morning they have already left, and this included some very, you know, like quite senior officials, people who were really important for the work, for the production of that company. They all just disappeared in 24 hours. And of course, it impacts, you know, basically they say the whole factory now is not operating properly. People are shocked. They're discussing what happened. They're discussing what they should do. And that's the mood which is spreading around the industry.
Nick, do you see any scenario where Russia can rebuild itself internally to reach the level of power it had in the world before this conflict began?
Well, that actually touches on something that Olga said about the changes in Putin's circle, because a year ago, 2 years ago, you had people like Igor Sechin, who is the CEO of Rosneft, which is the largest energy company in Russia. His economic advisors, like Kudrin, all laying out plans for how Russia would transform itself through its Arctic strategy, through making a transition to the hydrogen economy, all of these things that were going to sort of cement Russian power. Now he's surrounded by, as she pointed out, by military and intelligence figures. And so the question first is the composition of that structure. Do you bring some of these other people back? And Sechin is an interesting figure because we haven't really seen much of him publicly. Certainly he's not being featured in any of the meetings with the president. Two big questions. One, and you, Thane Gustafson raised that issue. If Russia's economic links with Europe have been ruptured, Europe's ability and interest in contributing to Russia's economic modernization, which was at the core of the Arctic strategy, is called into question. And then if China and India, Japan and Korea are not going to step in to fill that role, then, and Olga was talking about it, this one enterprise, that will actually start to replicate itself across the country. And then you can't actually rebuild Russia, Russian power, on the basis that even Putin 2-3 years ago was talking about modern economy, 21st century transitions. And Russia really then runs the risk of becoming a commodities exporter, largely pulled into the Chinese orbit and unable to modernize or to develop. And as a result, its ability to remain one of the great powers by the mid-century is called into question.
And Olga, similarly, inside the country, do you think Putin will be able to rebuild the support he once had?
Oh, it's a good question. The trouble is that the population is scared, absolutely disintegrated. There are, you know, even those small horizontal connections which existed, they're being destroyed now. And because the repressive machine is working, well, it has been working for at least 10 years, but now it's, you know, it's evolving. It's new repressive laws are being published. So people are being afraid. They're being afraid to talk, to express themselves. And Putin controls the narrative. And, you know, the more restrictive the system is, the harder it is to get the alternative point of view. People try to find ways, but if your population is gripped by fear and by the need to survive physically, to, you know, to keep your father in the family or to earn for bread, you don't think about support. And Russians have already, unfortunately,
well, I have to stop it there. Olga Ivshina from BBC Russian Service, thank you for joining us. Nick Gvozdev from the U.S. Naval War College, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.